is the needed time. Now is the needed time. We're living in the needed time.
Broadcasting from Brock University, this is 103.7 FM CFBU. Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time, we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we continue the discussion we began last week with Brock Professor of Political Science, Leah Bradshaw, about the decline of our downtown cores in many city centers, and what needs to be done to successfully revitalize them. We talked to a Brock medical and veterinary entomologist, Fiona Hunter, who along with her team will be studying West Nile virus and other insect-borne illnesses. And we speak with graduate student Michelle Shiborski, who is examining the theoretical aspects of superconductivity and recently was awarded a Vanier Canada Graduate Scholarship to continue her work. Inquisitive Minds is on the air. First up on Inquisitive Minds today, last week we began a discussion with Brock Political Science Professor Leah Bradshaw about how cities must find ways to reinvent themselves in order to revitalize their city centers. We are seeing that now with many new developments going up in downtown St. Catharines, including, of course, the Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts, the St. Catharines Performing Arts Center, and the Meridian Center Spectator Facility, all designed to bring people back into the downtown core. But is it enough? That was part of what was discussed last Saturday at a day-long conference held at Rodman Hall entitled Public Space, Urban Crisis. In our continuing conversation with Leah, we look beyond the conference last weekend and look at just what needs to be done to not only bring people into the city core, but keep them here as residents as well as participants. Some would argue you can't do too much once the proverbial barn door has been left open for so long. Is it even possible to reinvent a downtown city core now that people are used to living outside of it?
I think you have to think differently about it. I have some nostalgia. I was talking earlier for the old kind of neighborhood, and I think those of us who have lived in an urban core understand that there was a time when people lived in the downtown core across as at all social and economic categories. They lived there. Their lives were pretty much contained. We live in a different world now. It's a global world. You know, I keep coming back to this. You know, there's this great saying where people say, think global and go local. Can you do both those things at the same time? That's what I always think. And we do live in a world where people are so much interconnected. They have so much mobility. How can you tie people, for me, this is the big question, to the concerns for the neighborhood and the community in which they live? I mean, a lot of people don't spend their whole lives in the same neighborhoods. I mean, if you go back 50 years. I mean, most of us, I guess, who are native to St. Catharines, I'm not, but the people who are native to St. Catharines, you know, they probably, their parents lived here, they grew up here, their lives were shaped in this community, but that's not true anymore. And I'm part of the university community in which people are trained really for the kinds of skills that are mobile. So a lot of my students won't stay here. I mean, they will go wherever there's employment, and that could be somewhere else in Canada, it could be in a different country. So we want to encourage people to do that. Like I said, we live in a global society, but ultimately you have to care about the place in which you live. And so So I mentioned before that there are issues of social justice for me that you have to think about and care for the community in which you live. So I think you need to make a concerted effort to think about this, and you have to remind people. So I'm very optimistic about it, and I do think it's different now. I think about St. Catharines specifically. For me, a big concern, I think, is getting the university. I mean, the university, I think, is now the major employer in the Niagara region. We have 17,500 students there. Plus, think of all the faculty, the administration, the support staff. I mean, it's a huge operation. So what we want to do is integrate these people into the local cities. And I think that there are resources in the university that are incredible for this. That's why I'm so excited about the Performing Arts Center in downtown St. Catharines. So I think that you have to look at okay, what kind of city is St. Catharines now? It's not principally an automotive town anymore. It's a university town. University is the big employer. So the city's going to look different, but it's exciting because there are lots of things that people in the university can bring to the city. So that's why I come back to this thesis of Jane Jacobs, who I rely on, an urban theorist who lived most of her adult life in Toronto, who said that in the contemporary city, the arts are very important. The arts are really important for creating, if you like, a kind of space that is new, replacing what was there before. And you also want to encourage people as far as possible to employers and businesses to relocate downtown. One of the concerns, I think, for people who work in this kind of area is that you don't want urban spaces to be just for the so-called elite. You know, there's always this danger that you're going to have an aesthetic that is set up for people who can pay $4.50 for a latte. So you don't want just that. You need to attract people with income and taste and so on into the downtown core, but you don't want to make it a place that is inhospitable to everybody. So you have to orchestrate that. You have to think carefully about planning for that. You need to provide housing in the downtown core, as I said, that everybody can afford, because this is what makes for an interesting and vibrant city.
That is the crux of the problem. Getting more people. And being a part of the community in the downtown. When they are living here, and you've got the arts that we will have in the downtown as the Marilyn I. Walker School of Fine and Performing Arts develops and the Performing Arts Center, the people will have a reason to come into the city. Yeah. Then there are other businesses that will want to locate here. We're seeing that now with new businesses that are developing and opening up in anticipation of what's to come here in St. Catharines.
I think so. And then once you get an urban culture, I always think about this when I walk down St. Paul Street in St. Catharines, because there are these beautiful old buildings, and I always look up and see these fabulous living spaces on top of these buildings. You know, beautiful big windows, views out over the ravine where the new arena is going up. And all these spaces are underutilized in St. Catharines. So, of course, I compare this to Toronto. You know, when you walk along Queen Street in Toronto, and people are living in all these spaces, and they've got their little balconies and their flowers planted. And it's exciting. And as I said, it's a matter of changing aesthetic so that people begin to think, well, you know, I don't need this house in the suburbs. I want to live right down here where I can come down the stairs and be on the street. But you need things there for people. Like I said, I can buy my food here. I can get a coffee. I can go to a movie at night. That's what you need, all those things to happen. I think we've got a great start in St. Catharines. I'm very optimistic about it. I think that once the Performing Arts Center and the new arena go in, that it will make a big difference to downtown St. Catharines.
But will it be enough? More, I would think, would have to be done.
More has to be done, and I think there has to be a real emphasis on housing. The housing in downtown St. Catharines has to be made attractive to people. I do see a reverse migration. We were talking earlier about the configuration in a private conversation of streets in St. Catharines, but for anyone who lives in St. Catharines, in the streets that are close to the downtown, we already know this. It's a mixture of people. A lot of families that originally worked for GM, professionals, and so on, it's starting in a big way, I think.
I remember about a year and a half ago, I had an overnight stay in Buffalo. A lot has been written about Buffalo, which at one point in the early 20th century was, I understand it, one of, if not the wealthiest city in northeastern United States.
It's true.
You wouldn't know that in the last, say, generation because of the decline of the industrial age and how it affected the city of Buffalo. Yet, when I went back and I had an overnight, so I had an evening and the day. In the evening, it was a Sunday evening, I took a walk. I love to walk and I love to explore a city center. I walked and I was amazed by two things. One was the preservation of this amazing old architecture mm-hmm. that is still there, mm-hmm. the number of new buildings that have gone up.
Yeah.
But I was also struck by the fact that it was a veritable ghost town at 9 o'clock at night. Mm-hmm. There were no people experiencing the downtown once everything closed up for the day. Now, granted, this was a Sunday evening, but it appeared to be a problem that is endemic. Unless you have those people living in the downtown, you've got this great central core that empties out at the end of the day and is empty until the next morning.
It's a big problem, and that's why you do need to get people moving downtown and living downtown, not commuting downtown. I mean, it's a critical issue. You may have noticed in Buffalo, I mean, I noticed the same thing in Detroit. The architecture, though, this is why there's such an emphasis on architecture and public space. How you build the city, what you do with the city is critical. One of the things that I'm sure this you must have noticed is in Buffalo, same thing in Detroit, that the streets, they're huge. They're like highways. These cities were built for the automotive industry. And so the main arteries cutting through those cities are some of them like 8 lanes. It's like being on the QEW. These are not pedestrian-friendly streets. They're streets that were built for the car. So you have to rethink the way that you make the cityscape. I mean, one interesting thing in St. Catharines recently, again, for people who frequent the downtown, outside the farmer's market on James Street, they've closed in part of that street. And there are picnic benches there and flower pots and so on. And if you go down there on the weekend, you'll see people are sitting there now. If someone's playing music, people sit there. You have to create the spaces, the public spaces, for people to congregate. And it makes a big difference. So you have to think consciously about that and how you're going to reconfigure the space to make it hospitable for the public. You need congestion so that people will feel comfortable. People don't want to walk in an urban center that's like a ghost town. They want to go out on the street at night where there's a lot of liveliness and there are other people there. I was talking to my daughter who lives in downtown Toronto, said she never feels unsafe walking in the streets of Toronto because there are always people there. Mm-hmm. So actually the inner city is not an unsafe place if there are a lot of people there. So I think that's why you have to think really carefully now about these post-industrial cities, about what you are going to do with that downtown space. Again, we were talking in an earlier conversation, I actually participated in the movement a few years ago to get two-way traffic in St. Catharines. Again, using the arguments that I know about urban space, that if you take your downtown street and you turn it into a thoroughfare, a one-way thoroughfare, where people can zoom through on their way to the suburbs, they won't linger. They won't see what's there. They won't say, oh, that looks like an interesting shop, or that looks like an interesting gallery. I think I'll stop there. So what you have to do is actually create two-way traffic, a lot of stoplights, so that, first of all, it's friendlier to pedestrians, and secondly, the people who are in their cars will actually notice what is there. So all of these are incremental steps. I think about St. Catharines, two-way traffic, the closing off of part of James Street to make a public space where people can congregate, the farmer's market, the Canada Hair Cloth Company being turned into this magnificent new facility, the new arena downtown. These are all great things that will bring people to the core. So what we need is to keep generating that kind of thing, do it consciously, and do everything we can to make sure that people move into the downtown. All these things have to come together. That's why at the conference we had been talking about food deserts, to get people to reverse migrate from the suburb culture to the downtown culture. It has to be pedestrian friendly. There has to be food. They have to be able to access all those things in the downtown core. So all of that has to kind of come together simultaneously for an urban center to work.
The downtown civic square, this temporary civic square, I'm glad you brought that up because I think it's mm-hmm. a great concept. Some would argue that it opened much too late this season, although, mm-hmm. as you have mentioned, people are taking advantage of it.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that we're going to end up with a more permanent civic square mm-hmm. concept at some point. This past summer, I was up in downtown Guelph, another great university town. Their newly designed civic square, which includes a wading pool, skating rink in front of City Hall, and a lot of great shops and eating establishments and what have you. It's a fabulous way of revitalizing the downtown. Mm-hmm. And I can see that happening here, using that space on James Street next to Market Square and building something really great for people right in the heart of the downtown.
I know. You have to create public spaces. If you want people to come, you have to create public spaces where they can congregate.
Now, as far as the traffic is concerned, contrary to what some might have thought at the time, you talked about the two-way traffic, the world did not end when we came back to two-way traffic.
No.
Of course, back in the 50s, when we went with one-way traffic in downtown St. Catharines, it was for that very reason that you described, getting the people out of the downtown core. We still have that problem in Hamilton. I go to Hamilton every couple of weeks. I'm right downtown. I cannot believe the mass migration of people
I know.
In either on King Street or Main Street heading out of town. It's like like a highway with stoplights every couple of blocks. It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
It does get the people in and out of town. But when they come out of town, they are elsewhere for the balance of the day.
Mm-hmm.
Therein lies the problem.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, I think back to your initial question about, is it possible to turn back the clock? And I think, no, it's not possible to turn back the clock. It takes a lot of ingenuity to think about the new city. What kind of people live in the city? What kind of people are attracted to the city? How you are going to think about the space? It does require a lot of ingenuity and forethought to do this, and it takes planning, which is why the urban planners are so significant. You have to think consciously about this. The city is not going to grow up organically anymore. I think that it requires planning to do this.
You're not reinventing the wheel, but you are reinventing the city center.
Yes, I think so.
Leah Bradshaw, thank you again for coming in. It's been a fascinating conversation, and I'm sure we'll be talking again.
Thank you very much.
That was Brock political science professor Leah Bradshaw with part two of our discussion on revitalizing city centers, such as here in St. Catharines. We'll be back with more in a moment.
Child abuse is happening with the click of a mouse. Right now, someone is downloading child pornography off the internet. Child pornography is child abuse. You can help stop these crimes against children. Take action and report it. Go to www.cybertip.ca. Help protect an innocent child. Stop it. Report it at www.cybertip.ca.
Are you tired of cheesy mainstream cultural affairs radio program with its gratuitous nudity, slide whistle sound effects, and crash shoe phone giveaways? If so, you're tuned to the perfect frequency on your FM radio dial. The Pizza Box Cadillac Radio Hour ain't about the gimmicks and the doodahs and the fancy pants whatnots. The Pizza Box Cadillac serves up a gritty, unpretentious, keeping it real brand of cultural reportage that can only be described as authentastic. Tune in every Friday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon Eastern Time when the Pizza Box Cadillac Hour begins radiating across the airwaves live from the Welland House in beautiful downtown St. Catharines.
And right now you're listening to Inquisitive Minds, a presentation of Brock Radio CFBU-FM. An announcement from the Brock Co-op's programs office came my way this morning. They're hosting a series of co-op employment training workshops this fall that will help to prepare students for their upcoming work terms. The workshops are open to second-year undergraduate students and graduate students and cover program expectations, nailing that elusive job interview, and networking with industry professionals. Workshops include co-op employer mock interviews, frequently used business applications on a co-op work term, and brand yourself on social media, a very important topic these days. For more information about the sessions, including participants and dress code, all important dress code, contact the co-op programs office up at Brock. Speaking of which, if you travel up to Brock University these days, you can't help but notice a huge metal and glass structure sitting where a parking lot once resided. It is the new, having opened not that long ago actually, Cairns Family Health and Bioscience Research Complex. It is huge, 176,000 square feet worth of new science and technology infrastructure. It will be playing a key role in advancing Canada's science and technology research. In addition to researchers conducting world-class work in areas such as cancer, infectious diseases, biotechnology, and green chemistry, the complex also houses, of course, the BioLink Business Incubator we found out about on the program last month. One researcher at the complex is Brock Medical and Veterinary Entomologist Fiona Hunter, who, along with her team of researchers and graduate students, will study the West Nile virus and other insect-borne diseases. Hunter's research involves studying the behavior of mosquitoes and ticks, and she is particularly interested in the role biting flies and ticks play in the spread of diseases. Fiona Hunter joined us in our CFPU studios earlier this week to talk about the new containment lab in the Cairns complex that she will be working in starting today, as a matter of fact, and the research being undertaken there. And I asked her about the new complex.
It's a fantastic new facility, and we certainly waited for it for a long time. But now that it's here, it's really, really exciting to be working in there.
So how does the complex and the containment lab benefit the work that you and your researchers are doing at Brock?
Well, I started working on West Nile virus when it first came into Canada back in 2001. And I was asked to do surveillance for the federal government and the provincial government to actually look to see what mosquitoes were vectoring West Nile virus. And that at the time was really exciting because it was a new disease to Canada and we did a lot of the baseline work. But the problem was that over the years, we knew which were the important species of mosquito that were vectoring. And there were so many more questions that we could have asked but weren't able to because you can't deal with live infected mosquitoes in a normal laboratory.
Now, when you say vectoring, that means?
Vector mosquito is one that actually transmits the virus. So it would pick it up from a bird, because West Nile is actually a bird disease, and then at the next blood meal, transmit it to a human.
Could you have done the level of work that you're doing now without the Cairns complex and the containment lab that you're now working in?
Absolutely not. We would still just be looking at dead frozen mosquitoes and testing them to see if they had the virus, but we couldn't actually do any exciting research about the mosquitoes themselves and the interaction that they have with the virus.
Now, on the subject of the West Nile virus research you're going to be doing, when does that actually start? Because I understand you have to seal off the laboratory that you're going to be working in.
Yes. The start date is October 23rd.
Why is it you have to physically seal off the lab? Is it basically to contain the germs that you're going to be working with?
So we physically have to shut the doors to the lab and only allow access to those people who are trained to go inside because we don't want to risk having mosquitoes that are infected with the virus getting out into the hallways and into the general public. That the containment lab itself has got many layers of security inside that make sure that there are no escapee mosquitoes.
Wearing white and black striped outfits, no doubt, as well. Sorry, I just had this vision going through my head. I read something about the people are going to be working in there. You can't even wear your street clothes when you're in the lab.
No.
Which, when you think about it for a moment, it does make sense because you would not be able to wear them out of there again.
That's right. Anything that goes into the lab has to be autoclaved out. So an autoclave is a big oven, essentially, that cook sterilizes things. So if we were to go in with our own clothes on, we would have to sterilize them. And so we'd be walking out of the lab with nothing on, which is just not a feasible alternative.
So the lab wear that you're wearing when you're in there, you say you have to bake it.
It's more like a steam clean. It's 121 degrees in the autoclave. And yeah, it just kills anything that's on it. Well, there's no washroom in there, for one thing, so that if you want to work a full day, you have to don your scrubs, go in, work in containment, and then you have to take your scrubs off and shower out to go use the washroom. And then you have to come in and repeat the process if you want to work.
Every time?
Every time.
Wow.
So there's absolutely no way that any of this virus is going to get out into the general public because we're keeping it all within the containment lab.
When you think about the logistics, as you've just described, no wonder there are so few facilities like this around because of the precautions you have to take. And on that subject, you're the only Canadian university that has a lab such as this, I understand.
We're the only Canadian university that has a lab with an insectary, meaning that we can actually work on live infected insects. There are other level 3 labs at universities elsewhere, but they are dedicated to other types of research, maybe HIV research or something else, but definitely not a mosquito-borne disease lab.
So when we're talking level 3 containment lab, level 3 is referring to what?
There are actually 4 levels of containment that are used to describe the security level in a laboratory. And a level 1 lab would be like a high school science lab with doors that are open all the time and there's nothing really dangerous going on in there in terms of biological pathogens. A level two lab is like most of the labs at the university, where doors are shut, there are sinks, possibility of any splashes, you would have an eyewash station. So that's protecting the people who are working in the lab, and there is security because the door is shut. And then in a level three lab, it's like a biological cabinet itself, which means that not only do the doors shut, but there are several doors that you have to pass through as you go into the facility. And there's a negative airflow so that all the air is really being sucked from outside into the facility and then out through filters, so that the air change is very frequent, so that there's always fresh air coming in and it being vented out through these HEPA filters. So the containment level three lab is much higher security than a level two in terms of the number of doors, the airflow, what's found inside it. And then a level four lab, which is the highest security level, that's where one would actually wear a suit with a hose attached to it for respiration. It would be for working with things like Ebola virus, which we certainly would never be able to work with in our lab, nor would we ever want to, quite frankly. So the level four is the highest containment, where the people don't actually breathe the air that's in the lab. It's all vented through hoses.
As far as the level three is concerned, and talking about the air, and here we get back to the logistics. When you were talking about that, my first thought is, of course, that air could not be recirculated anywhere else in the building. You can bring the fresh air in from outside, but when you take that air from the lab out, where does it go? Because you can't use that again. Does it end up being purified somewhere?
Yes. So there are HEPA filters that purify the air and then release it to the outside. So it's purified air that's being released.
And there again, that's something that you have to take into account when you're designing a facility such as this that you couldn't do in just any other room within the confines of the university. It has to be purpose-built for this lab.
That's right.
We're talking with Professor Fiona Hunter about the Level 3 Containment Lab at the Cairns Family Health and Bioscience Research Complex at Brock University. Now let's talk about your work on the West Nile virus that is getting underway as of now. We hear every year, it seems, people stricken with the virus. What is West Nile virus, first of all, and how contagious is it?
So West Nile virus is actually a bird disease, and some birds actually get very sick from it and die, such as crows and blue jays, and other birds get it but don't actually have any symptoms from it, or so it appears. And they are the birds that could potentially be amplifying the virus out there in the wild. And every time a mosquito comes and feed on one of these infected birds, it can pick up the infection. And normally what the mosquito would then do is go lay a batch of eggs and then come back to another bird for another blood meal. And as it feeds on that next bird, it can transmit the virus to that next animal. So the virus itself gets into the mosquito and then it replicates inside the mosquito. And there's so much virus in the mosquito that it gets into its salivary glands. And when a mosquito bites, it's only the females that bite, she actually spits into you first to make sure that your blood doesn't clot as she's trying to drink it up. So the purpose of spitting into you is to put in an anticoagulant and also an anesthetic and some other proteins. But the virus sort of hitchhikes in that saliva and gets spat into the next host. So there you have the bird-mosquito cycle. And at some point during the year, and it's generally later in the season, these infected mosquitoes either can't find birds to feed on, or they just fortuitously come across some other animal, such as a mammal, which would include us. And then when they bite us, if they're already infected, they spit the virus into us, and we end up with West Nile.
So in other words, it's starting with the birds. Does it ultimately prove fatal to the birds, or is it just something that they happen to carry around?
For several types of birds, it is fatal. So birds in the family Corvidae, which includes the blue jays, ravens, crows, appears to be fatal for them. But also some of the owls and raptors, the hawks and birds of prey, it can also be fatal to those animals, to those birds as well.
Now, does it ultimately prove to be fatal to the mosquitoes who carry that virus, or are they more or less just a carrier of it?
Well, the common wisdom is that the mosquitoes are just carriers of this virus, and that's where our lab comes in, that we actually think that if a mosquito is so chock-a-block full of virus that it's being able to pass through its tissues and pass through the membranes and get into the salivary glands, it has to be causing some sort of deleterious effects to the mosquito. So even though the common wisdom is that they're just the transmitters and it doesn't affect them, we are going to be able to test the hypotheses that it does shorten their lifespan if they're infected. We'll test whether or not it reduces the number of offspring they can possibly have. So that's where we're going forward and doing this exciting work.
So that's the work that you're going to be embarking on in the lab.
That's part of the work that we're going to be looking at now. This has opened up so many windows of opportunity for us that we can look at the effect of the virus on the mosquito. We can look to see if the mosquito can transmit to her eggs and look for transovarial transmission. We can look to see what different diets, if different sugar meals that the mosquitoes have, does that influence how much virus they ultimately transmit? So we can now look at it from the mosquito perspective, which is what our lab's all about.
I was curious about the sugar meal aspect of it. I've never given any thought at all in my entire life to what the diet of a mosquito would be other than our blood when we get really annoyed as they bite us. Is there a particular diet that is preferential to a mosquito?
We have some basic information about mosquitoes that it's only the females who ever blood feed. And even then, not all egg batches require a blood meal. There are some mosquitoes that have so many nutrients left over from the larval period that they can actually mature a batch of eggs without having a blood meal. So that's another really interesting aspect of mosquito biology. But it's only the females who ever take a blood meal. And when they do, it is to get protein from the blood so that they can mature a batch of eggs. But both males and females, so both genders, have to have energy for flight and all the other things that they do, and they get that from sugar. And the common sugars would be floral nectars. They'll go inside little flowers and feed on the nectar in there. But they can also feed on things like aphid honeydew, which is essentially aphid poop, which is very sweet. It's also known as manna from heaven.
Really?
They will feed on aphid honeydew and get sugars. And that would be both males and females. So we're really keen to look at the influence of all these other aspects on their ability to transmit the virus.
Aphid honeydew. Okay, so the female mosquitoes are the ones who are getting the blood meal. The first thought that came through my mind is, outside of procreating, what are the guys doing? What are the male mosquitoes doing in all this?
You have hit the nail on the head right there. Males have no real function other than to mate with the females and then die.
That's it?
Yes, that's it. And a female only needs to mate once. She can store the sperm from a single mating and use that for the rest of her life. So males are really expendable. They have to have enough energy to find a female to mate with, and then if they can mate with several females, that's good for them, but otherwise, they're done.
Don't even have to go out and get a job and support the family. It's amazing. I didn't realize there are more than one species of mosquitoes. How many are there?
In Canada, the current mosquito count, I think, is 82 species. And we have a couple of new species we're going to add to that list that are range expansions from the States. So it might be up to about 84 species then. In Ontario, we have about 42. And of those, generally about a dozen of them test positive for West Nile virus.
So when a mosquito is hovering on our arm on a summer evening, the first reaction for all of us is to kill it. But now I'm going to be looking at every mosquito that hovers near my arm and wonder what species it is and whether it's going to be carrying the virus. Should we just be proactive and avoid all of them all the time as best we can, or are some less of a problem than others?
There are certainly mosquitoes out there that don't pose any risk to us at all. There's one mosquito, for instance, that specializes on amphibians, so it feeds on frogs. Mind you, it wouldn't be attracted to us anyway because we're not cold and clammy usually. But from the mosquitoes that are actually attracted to us and are coming to take a meal, I think it's better to be safe than sorry. Try to avoid mosquito bites.
So that being said, what should we be doing to protect ourselves from insect-borne viruses such as West Nile to begin with?
The public health message has always been to avoid being bitten at dusk and dawn, that those are the times of day where mosquitoes are most active, especially those species that are known to transmit the virus. That being said, there is an invasive species now in Ontario that is originally from Japan and got into the southern states and then made its way up to Canada, and it's moved all the way up to Thunder Bay, I believe. This particular species likes to bite during the day, and it has a very piercing, sharp little bite, and it can also transmit the virus. So even though traditionally the message would have been avoid mosquitoes at dusk and dawn, now we have this day-biting mosquito that is also a potential vector. So really, just avoid being bitten.
Climate change, does that play a factor in any of this as to what they are bearing, West Nile or any other virus?
I think the common understanding is that these viruses amplify in mosquitoes in a temperature-dependent fashion. And a mosquito is actually a cold-blooded ectothermic animal. And so whatever the temperature of the outside air is, that's the temperature of the mosquito. Unlike us, of course, because we can regulate our temperature. And that means that if it's warmer, then there's more opportunity for the virus to replicate. And if it's cooler out, the virus replicates very, very slowly. So with increased average temperatures and longer growing seasons, not just the West Nile virus, but other viral infections of mosquitoes will have the opportunity to replicate and potentially be transmitted.
Now, since we're so close to the border, is the border an issue here at all? In other words, are rogue mosquitoes from the U.S. hitching a ride over here and that's presenting a problem as well, or is that not a factor?
I am really pleased to be working at Brock, for one thing, because we are just at the border. This is the gateway to southern Ontario, and mosquitoes do come up through the peninsula. We're able to catch them or trap them as they are making their incursions into Canada. That's what we managed to do with that invasive species from Japan, which is actually called Japonicus. We were able to see it first in Niagara and then track its northward movement. So absolutely, being here in Niagara, we can see when the new nasties are coming in.
So the work that you're doing here at Brock University in the Cairns Complex, the Level 3 lab, is that going to be benefit primarily to Ontario, or are there benefits beyond the province of Ontario, the findings that you come up with?
There will definitely be benefits to Ontario by having this Level 3 lab here, but much broader implications for benefit, because if there are new invasive species coming up or new invasive diseases, we'll be able to work on them as they arrive and therefore get some baseline information that can be of benefit to other provinces.
Now, just out of curiosity, are mosquitoes the worst culprits when it comes to insect-borne diseases, or are other insect species just as bad? We just don't think of them as much because we hear of mosquitoes and West Nile virus every year.
I think mosquitoes are one of the worst insects out there for transmitting diseases. And probably the other arthropod that is making a bit of a news sensation right now is the tick, the black-legged tick, which transmits Lyme disease. And that is going to be the next big scourge here in Ontario.
Your work is never going to be done, I suspect that.
No, it's awful for me to say that. I certainly don't want any new emerging infectious diseases to come, but they are going to come, realistically, and at least now we're prepared, which is the exciting thing.
And we thank you very much for your work, and Fiona, we thank you very much for coming in this morning. This has been fascinating. I've learned so much, and I'm going to be really vigilant with those mosquitoes from now on.
Thanks for having me.
That was Professor Fiona Hunter, a Brock medical and veterinary entomologist, who, along with her team of researchers and graduate students, will be studying West Nile virus and other insect-borne illnesses in a sealed lab at the Cairns Family Health and Bioscience Research Complex. We'll be back with more in a moment.
This is a small dog barking. This is a medium-sized dog barking. And this is a big dog barking. Regardless of a dog's size or breed, its bite is always worse than its bark. That's why Canada's letter carriers kindly ask that you keep your dog indoors, in a fenced yard, or tied securely away from your mailbox. You may think your dog won't bite, but statistics say otherwise. More than 70% of reported dog bites happen at home and involve family pets. So please, be aware of where your dog is when we're delivering your mail.
Hola amigos, regresamos con tu programa favorito Sabor Latino. Lo bueno se hace esperar con la música que te hace vibrar. Y aquí están de nuevo Adriana y Oscar con su programa Sabor Latino, la radio que te pone a gozar.
Todos los domingos desde las 11 de la mañana hasta la 1 de la tarde en CFBU 103.7 FM.
Con noticias, deportes, farándula y lo mejor de la música actual.
Así que sube la radio y ponte a gozar con la música favorita, la música de Sabor Latino.
This is Inquisitive Minds on CFPU-FM. I'm your host, Mike Saunders. International Open Access Week runs through until October 27th, celebrating academic research and access to information. And the James A. Gibson Library is hosting a series of presentations throughout the week to help students, faculty, and staff better access information. Currently, Brock's library spends about $2.6 million a year on materials. About $1.8 million of that is on scholarly journal and database subscriptions alone. Now, faculty, students, and staff at Brock can access these journals, but if they leave the university, they lose those privileges. With open access, everyone could access the information for free, whether or not they attend Brock. And that's good to know. Now, did you graduate in 2011? Starting in November, all graduates from across Ontario who completed their undergraduate degree will be contacted by email and letter to complete a survey. The survey is your opportunity to tell Brock University or whatever university you did attend about your employment and education experiences since graduation. Your response helps to determine the graduate employment rate of your program, institution, and graduating year. This helps current and future students by providing them with information about employment prospects of recent graduates like you. Last year, over 25,000 Ontario University graduates like you completed the short survey. It's being conducted by CCI Research Incorporated on behalf of Brock University and the Ministry of Training, Colleges, and Universities. And only summary data will be shared. No data identifying individuals will ever be made available. If you're interested in the survey, there will be prizes awarded, incidentally, and you can get more information on it by contacting the Director of Institutional Analysis and Planning at Brock, 905-688-5550, extension 4776, for more information. Here on Inquisitive Minds, we tend to gravitate towards other inquisitive minds. And today, our final conversation is with a fine example of that. Graduate student Michelle Szydborski is fascinated by superconductors. No, these are not exceptionally gifted conductors on trains, although you could make a fair argument for superconductors having a useful place on trains of the future. Rather, superconductors can be materials ranging from elements such as aluminum and mercury to metallic alloys and even compounds. For example, high-temperature oxides that demonstrate unusual electrical and magnetic properties below certain temperatures. Michelle, a PhD physics student at Brock, is examining the theoretical aspects of superconductivity. Others have taken notice of her work, and in fact, Michelle has been awarded a Vanier Canada Graduate Scholarship for 2013. Michelle joined us in studio recently to discuss her work and where it will take her in the future, but I asked first what drew her to physics in the first place.
It's actually kind of interesting. When I first came to Brock, I actually came for biology. I participated in grade 12 in a science mentorship program, and I actually did a research project in kinesiology department. I don't really know what exactly why I switched into physics. Once I got to university and I was in the course, in the biology courses, I just didn't enjoy it as much as I thought I would, and I had taken physics as an elective, and I thought it was great. I felt so proud of myself when I could solve those complex problems and when I could understand the math and everything, and second semester I switched right into physics, and I've been with it ever since.
Was there a history of scientific research in your family?
No, actually, I'm the first person from my family to go to university. So this has been a huge learning experience for my family, my brothers, my sisters, my mom, and myself. But they all love hearing about my research, and they're all very supportive. So it's interesting.
Why did you choose Brock University?
I chose Brock University because I had done the mentorship program there, and I had already made relationships with faculty at the university, and I had already known the campus because I was there for 4 months or 6 months before doing this co-op program. And I also wanted to be close to home, to be honest with you. I was born in Niagara Falls. I've lived in Niagara Falls my whole life, and it's just really nice to drive into school, go home and have some separation for the rest of the day after school, and it's just a very warm environment. Feels like a little community, and I thought it was really good fit for me. I've had some really interesting research opportunities. I've been able to do research pretty much every summer that I've been there as an undergraduate student. I was able to apply for NSERC Undergraduate Student Research Awards, and I was awarded these pretty much every summer. So I was able to get involved in research right away, right in second year, publish papers, and it's fantastic. I feel like I've had many more opportunities at this school than I maybe could have had at a larger university where it's much more competitive. So I'm really happy that I chose to stay at Brock.
As enjoyable, I suppose, as it is to live outside of the community you grew up in and go to university because you experience a new community and everything, there's problems involved in that, with homesickness being one of them. When you are away from home, if you're having a crisis, for example, with your education, it's that much harder to deal with it.
Yeah, whereas you're so disconnected. I had support through everything. Every exam that I was stressed about, I had my mom there saying to me, oh, you're going to ace it. Don't worry about it. You've studied. You'll be fine. And I've always had her encouragement over the years. And I feel like that's what got me through a lot of the difficult times, because I mean, it is stressful when you have to write 5 exams in 3 or 4 days or something. It's very stressful to compile all this information you've learned over the semester and even take stuff from previous years and try and remember everything and apply it. So it's really good to have that family support.
So talking about that, how do you cope with that kind of a workload? What worked for you?
TV. Unwinding in the evenings, watching some TV, writing songs. I just actually joined the band called PH6 with Tomas Hulitsky, and Costa Medalitas are the ones who organized the band. So that provides a huge outlet. We just actually performed on July 19th in the Market Square. So that's a big outlet. When, you know, whenever I'm feeling stressed out or something, I'll just get a beat in my head, write a song down or something, sit in front of the TV, relax, write a song, and that really helped.
Musical instrument, or you sing?
I sing, yeah. I try and play the piano, but I'm not as good as I'd like to be, so I've given up. You know, over the years, I took vocal lessons, so I had to learn music theory, and so over the years, I would try and play the piano, but I'm not. My idea of where I'd like to be is much higher than what I can actually physically do, so.
So you're the singing PhD major.
Singing PhD major, yeah, singing physics major, yes.
Well, let's talk about the Vanier Graduate Scholarship. What's the aim of the scholarship, first of all?
The aim of the scholarship is to support world-class doctoral students who are doing cutting-edge research. I think it's to support their actual studies, so to travel to conferences, to go and maybe work at another university, which is something that I plan to do over my PhD. So it helps to support that financially, but also I think these awards give motivation and encouragement to students who are doing really well and at the top of their fields to try and continue down that same path to be successful.
Were you at all surprised to receive the scholarship?
I was definitely surprised, because the year before, another physics student, Drew Marquette, was awarded the Vanier Scholarship in the physics department as well. So it was very unlikely that two physics majors would get it back to back. But when my application actually left the school and I found that they were actually forwarding it to the government, I had my fingers crossed. I was very hopeful, but I didn't want to expect it and then be disappointed. So, I mean, I was very surprised and very delighted to find out that I was awarded it.
Now, you touched on this briefly a moment ago, but what's it mean to you personally? What can you do now that perhaps you couldn't have done without receiving the scholarship?
I would like to travel to another university and probably spend a year doing research. So that would fund fund my research. On top of that, it puts me in a very good financial situation for when I'm done my PhD. And this was honestly a big concern for me because a lot of students have debt from their undergraduate degrees. And even some students who are doing graduate work, if they're not directly funded by some sort of scholarship, they could end up having to apply for OSAP and they could get in debt in their graduate degree as well. So a lot of students have debt. I also have debt. And this helps pay off my debt, helps put me in a good position for when I'm going to postdoc, possibly supplement my income when I'm postdocing, and just give me better opportunities, go to conferences, but not have to have the stress of worrying about money while I'm doing my PhD. That's the biggest thing.
That's the scary part of a university life. You have that debt hanging over your head. And so your first years of working, as great as it may be and as well paying as it may be, you're not making that full amount because you've got this huge debt to pay off.
And I've also been told by supervisors in my department that when I'm postdocing, I will not make as much as I am doing my PhD. So by then, you know, it's taxable by that point when you're working full time. So, I mean, it's possible that if I do go to another country or something that I will need to supplement the income. So that's why it's really important to have this award for the future as well.
So let's talk a bit about your work and what you've accomplished so far. In layman's terms, what are superconductors and how can they be utilized in everyday life?
In layman's terms, superconductors are materials which exhibit, below certain critical temperatures, they exhibit zero electrical resistivity, and they also exhibit a magnetic phenomenon known as the Meissner effect, where they completely expel magnetic fields from their interior. So there are many potential applications. Some are based on this electrical property, and some are based on the magnetic properties. In terms of the electrical, the zero resistivity, I think Hydro had this idea years ago to send power really long distances because of the fact that there's no energy dissipated as heat loss, there's no power loss, you could potentially send power very long distances, and effectively what you send on one end is what ends up on the other end. So it's very efficient. Now the problem with these is that the critical temperatures where these materials become superconducting are low. So you need to use something like liquid helium or liquid nitrogen to cool them. So there's always expenses involved with this. And this is why people are looking for room temperature superconductors, because obviously if you wanted to change the wiring in your house or something like this to be more efficient and use some sort of superconducting material, it obviously would be better if you didn't have to keep it cooled with liquid helium. The expense of that is, I mean, liquid helium is thousands of dollars for a big doer of it, so that would probably boil off in a week. But right now, superconductors are vital in the function of MRIs. They create, and NMR spectrometers, they create the really big magnetic field. When you go into an MRI and you go in the big tube, there's actually a big coil around you of superconducting wire. And this is the coil that creates the really large magnetic field, which is homogeneous, so it allows them to see on a very, very small scale what's going on. What other applications? There's also the magnetic levitating train, or the superconducting levitating train. There's a very good video of it on YouTube by Dresden University, just a model one where they explain exactly how it works. But there's also one in Japan that's actually they want to use for transporting people. So the point of it is that because the train levitates, the friction is, there's virtually no friction. And so the train can travel at very, very, very high speed, whereas conventional trains which use ball bearings, the grease will burn out and dissipate at certain speeds. So there's a finite maximum speed that you can go with conventional trains.
So this is the Meissner effect we're talking about.
The Meissner effect, exactly.
It sounds like a fascinating concept. How far are we from a real-world application of that?
Well, I mean, there is a train in Japan right now, and they are testing it. So it's a full-size train, and this thing goes 300 kilometers an hour. Don't quote me on that, but about maybe 300 or something. I think in the video it got up to close to 300. But I don't really know exactly where they are in the stages of that, but I do know the train has been built. I've seen the videos of them testing it and stuff, so I'm not sure if it's actually running for human transport yet or if they're still in the phases of testing. But I mean, we're pretty much right here.
It's the cost factor that presumably is the elephant in the room here.
And I think the biggest thing, like, I know the materials themselves are expensive to buy, but I think the biggest thing is the material that you need to use to cool it so far. Because if, for example, you sent a line from here to BC underground or something like this, of some sort of superconducting material to transport power or something, you also have to somehow have some cooling agent also going along this line with it. And that's expensive. That's a lot of liquid helium or liquid nitrogen or something that would boil off. So then you also have to have a good refrigeration mechanism. And there's a lot of different factors that are involved in this.
Now, you suggest implementing superconductors into the world's electrical power grid to minimize the losses. Mm. It's a great idea, but again, it's the cost factor, yes. I suspect. And we're barely able to cover the yes. cost of our electrical grid the way it is now, aging as it is.
And this is exactly why people are trying to find room temperature superconductors. So over the years, back in the day, I'm trying to think what would be when mercury was first discovered to be superconducting by Camerlingones. I think the transition temperature is around 4 Kelvin, which would make it negative 269 degrees Celsius. So he needed to use liquid helium to cool this. And 3 years before he discovered the superconducting behavior of mercury, he liquefied helium for the first time. So over the years, as our technology has gotten better, we've been able to either synthesize materials or just examine the properties of materials and find materials with increasing critical temperature. So right now we have the high temperature copper oxide, but we're still a ways away from finding room temperature superconductors. So if somebody could develop a material or something that's room temperature superconducting, I mean, you could use water or something to cool these and make sure that they're at the same temperature so they remain superconducting. And that would be much more available than liquid helium, much more cost effective.
So what's next for you? Where do you go from here?
Well, once I finish my PhD, so I still have a lot of work to do. I'm just starting out. I've got 3 years. Once I finish that, I'd like to postdoc, and I would hope to obtain a job as a professor at a university. I'm not really sure what the job prospects are like, but I just hope that if I work hard and publish papers and do well at my research, and I have these awards behind me and whatnot, so hopefully luck's on my side.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the possibilities once you leave university life, because you're going to eventually leave university as a student.
I don't want to, but...
I've heard that before.
Yeah.
I would think, personally, from my vantage point, the world would be your oyster. Mm. You'd really have your choice. University life, as you say, would be where you would want to stay. Would it be Brock University or some other university comes calling and offers you that plum role?
Yeah, it doesn't really matter to me where I stay. It's just being able to work at a university is the freedom that's available, the freedom with your research, the freedom with your day, to govern your day and work at the times that you feel like. You know, I like to be up late and I like to do my work starting late in the evening and whatnot and stay up all night and do it. I mean, I know that's not feasible in the long term, but for now, that's how I like to do things. But there are other opportunities out there besides working for universities. Going into theoretical physics, your options, I think, are maybe a little more limited than if I had gone into experimental physics, but potentially, maybe I would be lucky if I could get a postdoc at a national lab or something. I've also heard of people who have pursued theoretical physics and then they weren't able to find jobs, so they went into finance because the math is very similar. So it's easy to switch over into other fields. And I have also been considering other research opportunities in more medical related fields, more epidemiology and things like that. So I'm not really sure where this will lead me, but I just like to keep all of my doors open so I have as many opportunities as possible. And I just love research, just being able to do research. And I'm actually interested in so many things, to be honest with you. So just being able to do any research somewhere would just make me happy.
Staying up all night, spoken like a true student. That will change, I can guarantee you. Here's a fun question for you as we wrap things up. You talked about your music being, I guess, in a way, a release for you. What else would you do that when you close your books, you shut down the computer, and you say, I've had enough of this for this morning, because by then it's probably about 4 or 5 in the morning. What brings you pleasure beyond the music and beyond the university life?
Talking to my friends, hanging out with my friends, going out to grab a drink once in a while. Yeah, just try and stay social and stay connected to people and see what's going on in other people's lives. And you know, that kind of gives you a little bit of perspective on other things as well and gives you a little bit of separation. And right now, my mom is actually going through treatments for lung cancer. So just being there for her and being there for the family. And lately I've been cleaning the house and cooking here and there and stuff like that and just trying to help out between when I'm working and stuff and taking breaks. And that makes me feel really good, like I'm helping to support them. So that has been a good release over the last 6 months, I guess.
Michelle, we wish you the best of luck and thank you very much for coming in today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That was Michelle Szyborski, a PhD physics student at Brock, who recently was awarded a Vanier Canada Graduate Scholarship for 2013 and is currently examining the theoretical aspects of superconductivity. By the way, Michelle tells me one of the other ways she likes to relax outside of the university setting is to simply knit. I find that rather endearing in this age of studying superconductors, don't you? This past weekend at Brock University, the fall convocation was held. More than 850 graduates received their degrees and certificates from Brock this past Saturday as the university celebrated the fall convocation. Congratulations to all. Job well done from the team of one at Inquisitive Minds. And that's it for this edition of the program this morning. That concludes this edition of Inquisitive Minds on CFBU FM 103.7 in St. Catharines. My name is Mike Saunders. I hope you've enjoyed the program. You can contact me via email at any time at talk@cfbu.ca with show comments and suggestions. Until next week, always remember to have an inquisitive mind. The top of 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 the top of